Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. This episode is the second in a three-part series on libertarian views of free will. Today, we will cover agent causal libertarianism.
Our guest in this episode is Tim O'Connor, and as always, please submit questions that you have for us through our website, thefreewillshow.com, or through social media, at The Free Will Show.
Thanks for listening.
I'm happy to introduce Tim O'Connor, professor of philosophy at Indiana University. Tim has written on a wide range of issues in metaphysics, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of religion, and he's published many articles specifically on free will. He's also the author of an important book on the topic of today's episode. The book's called Persons and Causes, The Metaphysics of Free Will, and it was published in 2000 by Oxford University Press. Tim is also the co-author of the entry on free will in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is available for free online. We'll link that in the show notes. I should have mentioned this in our last episode, since Tim's co-author for that entry is Chris Franklin, who we interviewed as our last guest. So welcome to the show, Tim. Can you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm a philosopher with a wide range of interests in philosophy, but I'm especially drawn to thinking about the really big questions: mind, cosmos, God. I don't like to leave out any of the big topics. So I started thinking about free will in my second philosophy course after an intro course. And that second course was a survey of metaphysics taught by an old action theory guy that free will aficionados might know, Irving Thalberg. Irving had us read Richard Taylor's beautiful little metaphysics textbook. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And so 2 weeks into that course, I knew that I was born to do philosophy and metaphysics in particular, and I've really never looked back. Although I should say that coming from a blue-collar background, I had little notion that one could make a living thinking about philosophy and teaching philosophy. So I'm forever indebted to Irving for urging me to apply to graduate school, which I don't think I would have even thought to do otherwise. Anyways, reading Richard Taylor's discussion of the problem of free will, I came to worry that there was no alternative to determinism or mere chance, both of which looked like free will checkmate to me. And I took really seriously as an undergraduate the possibility that free will was an impossible concept, and I found that a bit disturbing. So I continued to study philosophy on into the graduate school, and I left that problem alone, unresolved, for a long time. In grad school, I studied a lot of medieval and early modern history of philosophy, and I expected to write a dissertation on Duns Scotus or Leibniz. But when the time came to choose a topic, I sharply veered, because I was drawn back to my philosophical first love or terror, the problem of free will. So I sort of figured that if nothing else, I would at least resolve that question to my own satisfaction. And I eventually did, though I'm occasionally haunted by a remark that Quine makes somewhere on the imperceptible transition from pious hope to foregone conclusion. I often wonder whether that sort of transition took place in me. But whatever the psychology of the ongoing evolution of my own views on free will, I gather it has gripped you guys too. With you, like devoting an entire podcast series to it. So,
yeah. Well, as Taylor mentioned, we talked with Chris Franklin in our last episode about event causal libertarianism, and you have defended an alternative view that is sometimes called agent causal libertarianism. Can you explain what it means for an agent to cause something? Maybe you could contrast it with event causation.
Right. I'm sometimes known as agent causation man out in the field. I need to say up front that I have come fairly recently, to think that this whole contrast which informs much of my own previous work, is in fact misbegotten. And that the villain here, as in much else in philosophy, is that enfant terrible, David Hume. Hume taught philosophers to downplay, if not jettison entirely, the notion of substance or object, and to think of the world as a kind of collection of momentary entities, happenings, or events. That's the kind of real stuff of reality. And then causation can only be a relation between such entities, such events. One, and as he thought of it, it's a relation that tracks or perhaps consists in certain recurring patterns among those events. So you might say for Hume, guns don't cause death and neither do people. The pullings of gun triggers cause death. Yeah. Okay. So one response to this view. So I'll tell you about how I've typically thought about it, and then maybe eventually we'll talk about what I've later come to think. But so one response to this view, which was expressed by Hume's much underappreciated contemporary, Thomas Reid, and which I also held for a long time, was to say, right, that's the right analysis of causation out there in the impersonal world around us. One thing giving rise, one occurrence giving rise to another. But it cannot be adequate to understanding our own agency, since it leaves out agents. It's a world of mere happenings in which no one does anything, except in a kind of derivative way, by being a constituent of an event that does something. So we kind of are taken along for the ride by the events that course through us. And so it doesn't look like we control our own behavior in a way that's adequate to the way we ordinarily think, in which we hold one another responsible and credit one another for things we do that are challenging or difficult. So we're then led to postulate a fundamentally different kind of cause, agent causes, where that cause is a purposive, willing agent, like ourselves and possibly other sort of agents there might be. So on this view, agent causes are ontologically basic, which entails that you cannot explain agent causation in the sense of reductively analyzing what such causings consist in. It's a fundamental relation. It's part of the fundamental fabric of reality. And it's a relation between an agent, an enduring substance, and some internal state, typically thought of as a willing or a deciding. But you know, the fact that you can't reductively explain it, it doesn't mean you also cannot explain it non-reductively. You can explain something non-reductively by describing the distinctive conditions of occurrence of the thing. You can kind of situate it with enough sort of trappings that you get a handle on it. In this case, the trappings are you have to understand that you have an agent who has goals and intentions, beliefs and desires, and is confronted by a situation of practical uncertainty where more than one option available has significant attraction to the person, and she can't have both, so she has to choose, and choice just is her causing this state of intention or decision that issues in the behavior. Another way of putting it, says our agent causationist, the person exercises her power by causing the coming to be of a state, call it an intention to here and now, say, to get up and walk to the fridge, which intention, when everything's configured right in her body and her surroundings, event causes the events that are her so walking. So agent causes sort of trigger or the initiator of a sequence of events that constitute behavior. So that was a bit of a mouthful, but that's the sort of standard agent causation picture. Maybe we can just start there, talk about it, and eventually I can tell you what I don't anymore like about it.
All right.
Well, I guess this is kind of a follow-up to that. Maybe you can ask for more clarification. Is agent causation a different kind of causation from event causation, or is it just that the causal arrow is going between an agent and an event rather than between two events?
Yeah. That's a good question. And you could answer same kind or different kind, depending on exactly what we mean by that, because it's how we're sorting. I mean, in one sense, there is just, I mean, if you're a realist, okay, let me back up. Mm-hmm. So David Hume, when I talked about his thinking causation is a relation that encodes certain kinds of recurring patterns out in the world between event types, Hume didn't think causation, of course, you know this, he didn't think causation was a kind of fundamental part of reality, or at any rate, he was skeptical about that. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit tricky how to interpret Hume here. So on the standard Humean view, the view that has come to us, that's come to be known as Humeanism, causation is just a fact about patterns. There's no relation like a distance relation among objects that you need to fully characterize the world and how things stand in relation to each other. Okay. So if you're thinking reductively about, if you say causation just reduces to general patterns among types of events, and it's not something that's an ingredient out there in the world, then the agent causationist is certainly going to have to say that agent causation is fundamentally a different thing because it's a real relation. It's okay. But suppose you're the kind of event causationist who thinks causation is a fundamental relation among events. Then is agent causation that very same relation? Well, I think fundamentally yes, because it's a productive relation. That's why we can use synonyms and terms that are very similar in meaning to capture it. And we're stuck with that. But it's a producing, it's a making happen. And that's true in both cases then. If you're a realist about event causation and you also think there is such a thing as agent causation. But it's also, there is a fundamental division here in that the kind of entity that functions as cause is different in the two cases, and the circumstances, the way we describe how it occurs is fundamentally different. Agent causation is guided by purposes and cognitive, consciously grasped reasons, whereas event causation is just to be understood in terms of clusters of powers, some powers triggering other powers into action. And so there's no rational relation that's needed to describe how it occurs in general terms. So in that sense, agent causation is it's a very different sort of the fundamental thing that is producing or causing.
The more I think about this, the sometimes the more confusing it gets. Another concept that you mentioned in the book, and I've heard you speak about before too, is emergence. So what is emergence and how does it fit into the agent causal view of free will?
Yeah. Emergence is a word that many people invoke to describe, or a skeptic might say to label, complex organized phenomena in the world, organized phenomena of which it seems apt to say the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Okay, So that's the kind of intuitive phenomena that people are trying to understand, and they often reach for this word emergence. So theorists, and this includes scientists as well as philosophers, who are interested in the question of understanding macroscopic phenomena and macroscopic causes and how they relate to their constituents, their microscopic constituents. So they go on to try to spell out a definite analysis of what such so-called emergence might amount to in general terms. And predictably, they do so in very different ways. And if you know how these things go, equally predictably, some go, you might say, deflationary, and others go inflationary. And I go inflationary. That is, I think there's at least a notion of emergence. Sometimes it's called strong emergence. That's an interesting notion, and which I tend to think has application in the real world. It's not just an interesting concept. I should say, before I say anything more, that if you want to have a overview of the ins and outs of this discussion about emergence out there in the world, it's not just about human beings, but other kinds of complex phenomena. If you can find a discussion of that with lots of empirical examples on my brand new article on emergent properties in that same Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that you mentioned.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Which is freely available online to people. So in a nutshell, as I think of emergence, a composed system exhibits emergence when its causal activity is not exhausted or entirely fixed by the activity of its parts and their interrelations. So its activity is, ontologically speaking, something over and above the activity of all of its parts and their interrelations and the interactions of those parts with the exterior of the system, right? All of that microscopic activity in and around an emergent system doesn't fully capture the causal activity of the system as a whole. So the system has, you might say, irreducibly system-level causal powers. And then emergence is relevant to free will, since human persons appear to be composite systems, organically composed systems. And just as determinism seems to threaten free will, according to some of us, from behind, if you like, right? It's a kind of threat from behind of, you know, the world and its prior causes, the structuring activity of its causes, propelling us towards a preordained future. That's the problem of the threat of determinism. But another threat is the threat of reductionism, on which all that a system does is fixed or determined by the activity and relations of the system's parts. So if I'm a composed entity, and if the blind and purposeless activity of my neurons, suitably arranged, and ultimately of the trillions of subatomic particles that compose those neurons, if all that asymmetrically fixes it, every psychological event in me, that is, it fixes every event in me, and my psychology doesn't in turn fix my fundamental composing stuff. And if that includes every choice I make, then it seems that the ultimate source of my decisions is that microscopic activity, which yeah. is non-intentional, non-purposive activity, not me. So you might call this the mm-hmm. threat from below. So it's a distinct threat to free will. So the reality of psychological emergence seems necessary to counter the threat from below.
One question that is frequently raised for agent causal libertarianism is how it can make sense of an agent's acting for a reason if the agent's having a reason is not the cause of the action. So there's the event of the agent's having a reason, but if that isn't the cause of the action, if the agent as a cause, as the substance is the cause of the action, How could the agent be acting for reason? So we found this sentence that was helpful from your book. It's on page 97. My reasons structure my activity, not just in the rough manner of partitioning the possible options to those comparatively few that are genuinely available and the many others that are not, but also in the more fine-grained manner of giving me, qua active cause, relative tendencies to act. So could you explain how an agent acts for a reason without that reason causing the action, or how reasons can structure my activity without causing it?
Yeah. So of course, there I'm taking the view that reasons do explain in by playing a certain causal role. Mm-hmm. In the production of my behavior, and some agent causationists would deny that, wanting to say that there's a kind of irreducibly teleological explanation of action. That is, you just talk about the goals or intentions that the agent had at the time of acting, and there. And since the action fits those goals, there's a kind of just a internal link between the state of my deciding or intending what it is I'm what kind of purpose is encoded in or that I'm aware of when I make a decision to act and some prior such purpose that I had, then there's an explanatory link, they wanted to say. And I agree with critics of that kind of picture that that's not fully adequate to capture what's going on. But all right, I just wanted to flag that rather than talk about teleological views. So, but then the worry is just to explain that carefully worded sentence you quoted. The worry for an agent causationist in saying, right, my reasons cause me to cause my choice, my intention to act, is that now it looks like, so now we're pushing things one step further back. So I'm just a link in a chain of dominoes that my reasons are the most proximate cause of me causing my intention, and then there are causes of my reasons, etc. So that sense in which I'm the source of my own activity seems lost. So what I want to say is we don't have to think of causes as producing our behavior. They don't cause in the sense of producing my causing my intention. Rather, a lot of causal factors are causally relevant to what happens simply by raising the probability of some events occurring, right? And that can happen without those prior events triggering in the sense of being a producing cause of the behavior. So that's what I was trying to get at. The suggestion would be that if I have a capacity to cause states of intention in myself, that is a capacity to make choices, understood in that way, then that's a capacity that is influenced by all sorts of things. I only have that capacity under certain conditions that are necessary for me, obvious conditions like being conscious and other sorts of environmental conditions. And I'm influenced, right? I'm not somehow blissfully hovering above the fray, watching an arena of interacting factors playing out in the world. Those factors run through me. I'm more or less well motivated to do certain things. Sometimes I feel inclinations to do things that I don't even know the source of. So I have very imperfect conscious understanding of all this. But it's a reality, right? And any agent causal view that would deny that would just be hopelessly implausible, at least of a theory of human behavior. Mm-hmm. Because much of the time, I'm not neutral between the options that I'm contemplating. even if I'm not decisively fixed in going in one direction, I'm often leaning in one direction or another. So how to understand that? Well, that seems to be the only clear way we have of understanding that idea of having inclination is to say we have to cash it out in causal terms. I have a certain causal, you know, objective probability of choosing in a certain direction. So that's what I want to say. And then if you say, well, I'll pause there. I'll let you ask the follow-up question rather than anticipating what it might be. I'll just say there is a sort of strange model, analog. It's an analogy that some philosophers like E.J. Lowe and myself and Helen Stewart have used in this context. It's the phenomenon of radioactive particle decay. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing about particle decay, at least on our contemporary physics of it, so just even if it doesn't turn out to be the final actual analysis, it's a coherent model that's taken seriously in physical science, is that atoms, I should say, decay into certain subatomic parts through an indeterministic process over an interval of time. Say a sample of many atoms, a large sample of radium, it has a so-called half-life, which means over a certain defined period of time, it can be expected to have to decay, half of its mass to decay. When individual particles leave the batch is radically undetermined. And the pattern, it's not a regular sort of pattern. It's not like every 5 seconds it loses a certain amount or something like that. It can be long gaps and then staccato bursts of decay, and it doesn't seem to admit of any clear description, any kind of clear pattern. Okay. You can influence that, though, it turns out. I think sometimes philosophers, when they discuss this, are unaware of this because you can energize the source, and so you can speed up that decay, but it still will be radically undetermined, random, to a word where I'm sure we're going to get to in a moment. Mm-hmm. When it occurs, it's guaranteed to happen at a much faster clip. So that would be an example. Okay, the point of this arcane analogy is that would be an example of, by bringing to bear an external energy source on a unstable sample like this, you can raise the probability of at least you can make more likely that particles will decay from this sample at a faster rate than would have been otherwise. So you're causally influencing. You're influencing the relative probability of individual events, but it's not a triggering cause. That's a very distant analogy. I don't know if that helps people. It may be too outre. And you probably have a lot of worries about that example, but at any rate, I'll throw it out there.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the problem of luck. We've already discussed this problem for libertarian accounts of free will in previous episodes. What do you take the problem of luck to be, and how should agent causationists or agent causal libertarians respond to the problem?
All right, I have to say that I think the so-called problem of luck is overblown. In fact, I think it's become a label that often stands in for any decent kind of argument. I'm stepping on a lot of toes here, and that may explain why a paper that I've been trying to get published, which I'm quite proud of, where I'm defending that view, keeps getting rejected. I think I'm stepping on the toes of the referees that they're sending this to. But all right, that's how I see it. Before trying to say how I understand it, I would encourage philosophers, and I do so in this paper that eventually will get published, one hopes. I would encourage philosophers to try to formulate the so-called problem or problems of luck without using such loaded words as luck, chance, random, or any of their cognates. I think it's very difficult to do that, right? But these are, of course, loaded terms. They're pejorative terms, and they often stand in when you just assert, well, that would be chance. Well, that would be random, right? We're supposed to say, checkmate. Okay. that's inconsistent with control, right? And surely if free will is anything, it involves exercising a certain kind of control over one's behavior. And these terms seem the opposite of control, right? But if there's a real problem here, we ought to be able to express what that problem is without recourse to those terms. We ought to bring in those heavy-duty loaded terms at the end, if we like, but not as part of the development of the argument that shows us that there's a problem of luck here. Okay. I should also say, I think there's some really interesting writing on the problem of luck. I don't mean to be dismissive in that sense. But at the end of the day, I think we need to get greater clarity on what the problem is. I think the person who's written perhaps the most helpful stuff, and his own views have evolved on this, is Al Mealy. Wrote a whole book on it, and he's subsequently, I think, he's even helped clarify some things in later articles. But I think you see in his own thinking, the problem of luck is kind of mutating, it's shifting, it's becoming something else. And I just think it's often hard to keep track because in certain philosophers' hands, you start off, the problem is some one thing, and then it seems under pressure of replies, it shifts into something else. What is the problem is supposed to be this, that look, if you think free will is incompatible with determinism and you think we have free will, well, then you think our behavior is undetermined some of the time. It's causally undetermined by antecedents. So just all the causal factors that come to bear on a freely willed choice do not suffice, in causally speaking, for the choice itself. Okay. And so then, okay, now you go in one of two directions. One says there's a problem of luck that has to do with control. The other says there's a problem of luck that has to do with explanation. Okay, start off with the control, the more metaphysical problem of luck. The thought is, if the decision I make is controlled by me, but all of my relevant psychological states, all my desires, beliefs, goals, intentions, right up till the time of choice, do not suffice to bring about the choice that I in fact make, well, then I'm not really controlling it because that's what it is to control something. It's for one's attitudes to be causally efficacious in bringing that about, right? And then there's a related problem of explanation. If those things don't causally suffice, those antecedent psychological states don't causally suffice for my choice, well, then they don't explain, or they don't explain in the right kind of way what I do. They don't explain why I made the choice I did rather than some other choice that, by hypothesis, was something that could have occurred in those very same circumstances. So they don't contrastively explain, is the lingo here. They don't explain why this rather than this alternative. So you don't have adequate control, or you don't have adequate explanation. And where that is true, what happens is a matter of luck. If it's luck comes in because, you know, luck is usually a positive thing, you know, good luck. Well, there's good luck and bad luck. Okay. So if I make a praiseworthy choice when I was capable in the circumstances of making a blameworthy choice, well, then I'm just lucky because my my psychology, you know, you could have had we could imagine a world parallel to our own where an agent exactly like me, down to the last location of a subatomic particle, right, diverges and makes the different choice for me. And if I'm praiseworthy, well, that's good luck for me and bad luck for my doppelganger off in that other world. Okay. So for problem of luck aficionados, of course, I'm starting to talk about the problem of cross world luck now. You know, this thing, it starts getting, we start divvying this up. Okay. So what do I think about all of that? I reject the terms under which the problem often gets expressed. That is, if you're an agent causationist, my control is exerted in the bringing about of the choice itself, right? It's not some antecedent factor that I manipulate, right, in the way that I can control the temperature of my room by pressing a button on the thermostat, which in turn leads to the, altering the furnace so that the heat comes on and the temperature of the room eventually shifts, right? That's an indirect form of control. Mm-hmm. And if there's indeterminism between what I do and what eventually comes about, well, that kind of limits the degree of control I have. If it's only a 50-50 likelihood that my pushing a button is going to have the desired effect, well, then I have diminished control, you might say. Mm-hmm. I can influence the likelihood of its occurring, but I can't really fully control it. That's not the right way to think about control over one's own choices. We make choices, right? The choices are things we do. And the fact that some antecedent factors didn't suffice to guarantee that I would make the choice that I do, that does nothing to diminish my control if, in fact, I am the causal agent of that event. But then someone says, well, okay, you say that, but there's still a kind of residual, you know, suppose they grant that, if they're not skeptical of the whole idea of agents causing decisions, they'll still say, yeah, but there's still a sense in which you were lucky that you agent caused the choice that you did. Because remember, over in that other world, there's that perfect duplicate of you who finds himself agent causing this different choice, right? And nothing seems to explain why you agent caused the choice you did and he agent caused that other choice. Here I want to say, well, first of all, well, there is a different explanation, different antecedent psychological states are relevant to explaining my choice as opposed to his. Even that we shared all the same antecedent psychological states, but only some of those states are relevant to explaining why I did what I did. Let's say the choice is between sitting down and helping my daughter with her schoolwork or going out to the pub and drinking beer with friends. Okay. Let's suppose I go to the pub, drink beer, and my doppelganger stays home and play and helps his daughter with her homework. Why did I go to the pub? Because I enjoy it. I was looking forward to drinking beer, which I like to do, and laughing with friends. Okay. And I'm aware that, you know, by going to the pub, I'll bring about these sort of outcomes. Okay. That explains why I made the choice I made. What explains my duplicates making the choice to help his daughter? Well, he desires to help his daughter succeed. He believes that he has a responsibility to do that and so forth, whatever the details are. So you're going to give a different even though we were intrinsically identical at the time, you're going to give a different explanation of our different choices. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, final thing. Sorry, I probably should let you interject. But final thing here, you know, this is where people say, okay, well, what kind of explanation is that? because those your desire to drink beer and laugh with friends, the other guy had that too, mm-hmm. right? In what sense does that desire, that prior desire of yours, explain what you did? And I want to say, well, it explains it non-contract. It explains what I did. It doesn't explain why did I make the choice I did rather than another choice that I was equally capable of making, that I wasn't determined not to make. Mm-hmm. So there's two different things you could explain. You could explain the choice itself, or you could explain a more fine-grained explanation, why this rather than that. That kind of fact, the fact you did this rather than doing that, doesn't have an explanation, on my view. And that's okay. That's the nature of undetermined events. They can't be explained in that way. But they can be explained. So I don't think contrastive explanation is the gold standard for explanation. It's just a sort of explanation that can be given in certain kinds of contexts, but it can't be given in other kinds of context. But it doesn't preclude the unavailability of contrastive explanation doesn't mean what I did was just random, mm-hmm. like as if a tree mm-hmm. just suddenly appeared here in the middle of the room I'm standing with no antecedent cause, an uncaused event, right? Radically uncaused event. It's not like that, right? It's explicable. Mm-hmm. It's just, it lacks that kind of deterministic, precluding all other possibilities sort of explanation.
I have a quick follow-up question. You can feel free to be as brief as you want on this. Do you think that agent causation is crucial to this story you want to tell in response to the so-called problem of luck? Or do you think basically the event causalist can mimic this response in terms of not needing to give a contrastive explanation of what the agent actually does?
Great. So this is part of what's really going on in this forlorn paper that can't get published, which is a brilliant paper, by the way. One of the best things that has been written on this topic in quite some time, let me tell you. It's really frustrating. But I really like this paper. Anyways, probably, we're recording, right? So I'll leave it at that.
It'll be published by the time that we've released this episode.
Yeah, okay. But in this, yeah, I think there's been a lot of confusion, including on the part of agent causationists, including myself up until fairly recent times. Because, right, agent causationists have wanted to say, yeah, event causation. This has been part of the standard shtick, right, of agent causationists against event causalists who just say, look, our agency just is the causal efficacy of our psychology, you know, roughly speaking. That is, we act in virtue of having desires and goals and beliefs and intentions and so on that under structured deliberation, evolve into decisions, causally evolve into decisions that lead us to do things. That's just what it is for us to exercise control over our behavior, right? And so if you have that picture, then the agent causationist comes along and says, yeah, but what you can't explain here is, you know, why did your psychological states give rise to the choice that they did? There's a chanciness, right? In between your having those states, there's an indeterministic gap and the choice itself, something you did. And so there's supposed to be some kind of erosion of control or explanation, according to the agent causationist. But I think that's just confused, actually. And the event causationist should say, no, look, we've got a different picture of what control consists in, mm-hmm. right? Rather than a primitive agent causal relation, we've got an event causal relation between psychological states and choices. And so my psychological states, you can't say, well, look, here's your psychology at time T1. And then here's the choice at time T2, right? The psychology it's there. And now we have to just wait and see what choice is going to, you know, follow that psychological state you were in. And there's a gap there. You don't control it. You have no means of controlling what choice follows. And the event causationist should say, no, you're leaving something out here. The causing of the choice by those antecedent states. That's a real relation, right? And it's precisely that causing, bringing about of the choice in which my control resides, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was the fact that these psychological states brought about that choice in me, and then my duplicate over there, certain other psychological states brought about his choice, different, distinct choice over there, and that's how he exercised his control. We exercised our control differently. I think it's precisely parallel. So really, the issue about event causation versus agent causation, it doesn't really add anything to the problem of free will. It's only how you prefer to think about the metaphysics of causation more generally that's going to influence which story you go for. That is, I now think that we should think of all causation as causation by substances. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that that I think we are agent causes. But that's not a weirdly different kind of causation from the kind of causation of computers and trees and subatomic causes like electrons and so forth. The only thing that it's a distinctively purpose. I'm a purposive cause. That is, I'm influenced, and so there are differences that have to do with how we understand purposive activity, the way reasons influence the causings of intentional agents. But there's no fundamental problem of agent causation as a radically distinct kind of causation, since all causation is substance causation. Agents are just a particular, albeit quite distinctive, kind of substance. We cannot deny the reality of purposive activity, mm-hmm. right? I mean, some very reductionist-minded right. philosophers and scientists start to worry they're losing their grip on the idea that we can be purposive causes because, look, at the end of the day, it's all the evolution of fields or systems of particles, and there's no purpose down there, and they reject any kind of strong emergence in the world. But, I mean, that's just absurd, right? Because purpose is presupposed in all human communication and in all scientific activity. How do we come to believe in electrons and such like? It's through coordinated purposive activity, right? And you can't understand the activity of science, right, without understanding it in terms of agents engaging in purpose, you know, mm-hmm. doing certain things for various reasons, communicating those things for certain reasons, and so forth. If you sort of somehow try to tell the story of what's going on in non-purposive terms, then you would no longer be able to tell a story on which we come to have reasons for believing in the output of such activity, right? Giving us a approximate guide to reality. Agent causation is different in kind from non-purposive activity in the world around us, but that's the real fundamental issue, and that's common ground on different views of free will. I should say, you know, there are hard and really interesting questions that I'm actually I spend a lot of time increasingly thinking about. Interdisciplinary questions concerning the necessary biological precursors of our having such a capacity in our evolutionary ancestry. How does purpose arise, mm-hmm. right? Surely it doesn't just boop, you know, got to just pop in at some point, you know. So there's got to be a kind of, you know, evolution is a gradual process. So there's a lot of fascinating questions actually in the philosophy of biology. But I think you have to start from, look, it's real. We do act on reasons. And so now let's see if we can tell a story about how that could have evolved from entirely reasonless kinds of structures. But it has to be received as fact. I can't resist quoting here. The early 20th century philosopher and emergentist Samuel Alexander said, look, emergence has to be received with the piety of the natural investigator. who could doubt it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I think what you've just been saying forestalls our last objection that we wanted to ask you about, which is, you know, some philosophers have complained that agent causation is spooky or mysterious or not in line with science. So we were going to ask you what you made of that objection and how you think the agent causalist will respond. Do you want to add anything more to what you've just been saying?
Yeah. So on the older picture where you have two different kinds of causation going on, there is a bit of weirdness, you know, and then it's just kind of rhetorical butt covering that you you have to engage in. Yeah, you know, well, it's or bullet biting or whatever, you know, you try to make that palatable. Saying, well, yeah, you know. So that a nice thing about this is, you know, unification is always good for explanatory purposes. Mm-hmm. So if we can unify our picture of the world and kind of minimize a divergence between radically distinct kinds, that's always progress. We're still going to have purposive and non-purposive, right? But that seems like a less fundamental divide in some ways. But maybe it's just a bulge in the carpet kind of thing, because there still is an important difference there. But the nice thing about it is it's not just the agent causationist who have to give an account of purposive activity and embedded within a non-purposive, more fundamental world. It's everybody who's thinking about free will. So that's progress. Great. If you
nice. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Tim. Where can listeners who are interested in following your work go to find you?
So a lot of articles are posted that I've written are posted on my website, which is just toconnor.org, toconnor with a O-R, toconnor.org. I actually need to update that, but I'm planning to do so in the next month or two. So by the end of by early 2021, that should be a fully updated website. The other thing I would mention, just thinking about this in relation to a class I'm going to be teaching in the spring, and was consulting this website called Closer to Truth, which is a really cool website. It's this. It's a PBS TV series. A neuroscientist who goes around interviewing scientists, philosophers, and theologians on the mind, cosmos, and God. So I have a lot of video clips on a bunch of topics, including some free will topics on that. It's very professionally done, and it's just there are reams of material. It's just really with some really good scientists and philosophers. So I like going to that website and getting materials that I can use in classes. So you can also check me out there.
Great. I've seen some of those videos. They're great. Yeah, we'll link all of those.
Yeah, excellent resource.
Yeah, we'll link all of that in the show notes too.
All right.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks again for being with us, Tim. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about non-causal libertarianism. And our guest will be David Palmer, who is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Tennessee.